At my home church in New Madison, Ohio, we don't have the teal hymnal, and that was one of my favorites out of the gray, so thank you all for singing that. I thought it was very lovely. Before I begin my sermon, let me remark on my very lovely stole today. You might be thinking, hey, that doesn't look like the one we gave Joel. Wasn't it orange and red and yellow? Yes, it was, and I will wear my fire stole on another day. This one was made by my lovely wife, Leanne, right there, who, when she saw the one you gave me, she said, oh, that one looks like fire, so I will make water. And she surprised me with it this fall. And as it turned out, water was so totally appropriate. So there we go. And so far, that's holding out good. This slide here, the classical music that was playing as we were gathering before the service started was this song here. I can post it later to Facebook if you're intrigued by it. Trelonius is one of Lithuania's most famous composers, and we were listening to a symphonic opera titled The Sea. H2O, two items of hydrogen and one of oxygen. That chemical simplicity is what makes water so common and so important. Water is necessary for all life as we know it. Most of the surface of our planet is composed of water. It's a regular and necessary part of our daily lives in a whole myriad of ways. Most of us in the first world are blessed with clean and accessible water, and this means we probably don't need to think about water too much. It's there. Now, if you've ever been out of water for a time, it's shut down for whatever reason, you realize just how much we depend on water for those 1,000 times a day you reach for the faucet and are like, oh yeah, that's right. It's not there. Given the centrality of water to our lives, to the planet, to life, it should hardly be surprising that water is a common symbol across virtually all religions, and that's what we're going to explore today. Our human ancestors around the globe and across time understood water as a font of life. For some of those cultures, water was so fundamental to their understanding of the universe that it was the source of the universe. And we saw that in the automated story for all ages today from the ancient Egyptian culture, where the entire universe originated with Nu, the primordial chaotic waters. In the Babylonian creation story, the gods and all subsequent beings arose from the meeting of salt water, Tiamat, and sweet water, Apsu. In ancient India, the book the Rig Veda tells this story. Then even nothingness was not, nor existence. There was no air then, nor the heavens beyond it. What covered it? Where was it? In whose keeping was there then cosmic water and depths unfathomed? At first there was only darkness wrapped in darkness. All this was unilluminated water. That one which came to be enclosed in nothing arose at last, born of the power of heat. So water then, for a good number of cultures, but obviously not for all cultures, was the origin point of the universe, the source for the life of the entire universe itself. For other cultures, water was not the source of the entire universe, but it was an elemental force, a creative building block, if you will, of the universe. I don't know if those things are large enough for you to see. The first column is from ancient Greece. In pre-Socratic Greece, the philosopher Empedocles theorized that the universe was composed of four elements: water, air, fire, earth. And Aristotle later added a fifth one, ether. And the supposition in their science was that the universe was composed of these five elements, and it was the proportion and ratios of those five things that therefore made things different and gave them their properties and their energies. The science in South Asia that was later spread through Hinduism and Buddhism identified the very same five elements, or panchatavas, also known as the five truths and the five nectars. And that's in the second column. In ancient China, They believe the universe was composed also of five elements, but a different list. Their list included metal and wood in place of air and ether. And from this, the Chinese believed that one could understand astrology and feng shui and medicine and music and the martial arts, that they all related to this set of five elements that included water. Understanding water as an elemental force is not a thing of the past either. Contemporary paganism uses a five-pointed star, as I've got there down there in the bottom right. It uses a five-pointed star or a pentacle as its symbol. And the five points of the star represent those original four Greek elements plus spirit at the top of the star. Now, whether or not a modern pagan might use that symbol or not, and whether they're theist or non-theist, I think it's fair to say that all modern pagans do honor water as an elemental force of the universe in some way. And in fact, many pagan rituals, it's common to begin and end the ritual by calling the four corners, the four directions, and the elements associated with those four directions. The earliest human religions to enter our historical record were all polytheistic. In other words, had many gods and goddesses. Deities responsible for water were universally significant across early religions because of the centrality of water in human life. However, which deity was in control of which aspect of water, that varied by culture. So I've got three different kinds of examples for you here. On your left is Oshun, a West African goddess. She is named, or a river is named in her honor, one of West Africa's largest rivers. She's responsible for fresh waters, for luxury and love, sexuality and fertility. And her waters are considered healing. Women having difficulty becoming pregnant will bathe in her waters and pray for children. In other polytheistic religions, deities were associated with rain and with the waters of the atmosphere. We saw that in the story for all ages. In another example, to the far right, is Chaak, the Mayan god of rain. Mayans believed that Chaak would strike the clouds with his axe, and that would produce rain and therefore enable agriculture. Kings and queens would perform rain dances to beg Chaak to do so and to bring the rain. The image in the middle is of the Irish deity Manaman Mac Liar, which literally means son of the sea. He owned a boat named Wave Sweeper that was drawn by a horse named Seafoam. He was able to conjure the mists and become invisible. He was the guardian of the dead and was the one who ferried souls across the water to the afterlife. In our culture, Christianity has created a narrative that monotheism is somehow more evolved, more advanced than polytheistic religions like these. And in that narrative, polytheism is seen as a relic, something that belongs to the human past that's now been eclipsed by the more evolved monotheism. Now, there's some historical truth to that. It is the case that polytheism is older than monotheism. Monotheisms generally grew out of polytheisms, but that doesn't mean that, therefore, monotheism is more advanced. That's a monotheistic narrative. Let me give you an example of why that's a false narrative. So going back to Oshun, these are different images of Oshun. The worship of Oshun is alive and well and continues to this day, so it's not a relic of the human past. And in fact, her shrine is a UNESCO World Heritage Site. That is what is in the two corners. She originated in the Yoruba culture. You may have heard of the Yoruba before, and part of the reason you may have heard of them before is that that ethnic group was heavily targeted by slavers in the 18th century. So many of the peoples in this hemisphere who have African ancestors have Yoruba ancestors. And the worship of Yoruba deities, including Oshun, continued in this hemisphere, particularly in Brazil and the Caribbean, and then to all the places where people from Brazil and the Caribbean have migrated. So the worship of Oshun, in fact, continues in our country as well, particularly among Caribbean immigrants. So at this point, the worshipers of Oshun number in the tens of millions. So in other words, Oshun worship would be one of the biggest religions on the planet. If you are interested in learning more about the worship of Oshun, and I can post this link into Facebook later if you're interested in it, there's a TV series called Sacred Journeys with Bruce Feeler, and one of the episodes was entirely on the religion of Oshun and the site there at Oshogbo. And before we move on from Oshun, I'd like to read a praise poem. Oshun, owner of sweet waters. Oshun, queen worthy to be praised. To make a crown of water in the womb is the gift of the compassionate mother. To waft breezes from the splendor of brass fans, the way to cool and make calm weeping water. As golden amber honey flows from bees, so love flows sweetly from owner of streams. Oshun, whose tears make plea that love is not enough in the world. In faded blue cloth water washed white, Oshun steps subtly from the stream to dance. Illustrious queen, modest woman in one, Oshun makes beautiful music with bangles of brass. Without water, my life is aimless, blown dust on the road. Without water, mourning eyes lacking recompense of tears. Oshun, worthy to be queen. Oshun, worthy to be praised. A fourth way water figured into world religions was as a form of purification. Water literally cleanses us physically, so it would only make sense that water would also play a role then in ritual and spiritual purification. We could talk about all kinds of religions and their role, water's role in purification. I'm going to use Shinto as an example. So Shinto is the ethnic religion of Japan, and the practice of ritual purification via water is known as hare. Hare can be performed on people, on objects, on buildings, and on groups of people, including the entire Japanese nation. Now, the nature of the ritual will then, of course, depend on the target of the purification. So these images are showing different kinds of purification by water. In this one, the priest has dunked a cloth in it and is casting the water out on people. You see purification under a waterfall there in the upper right. And then this, where you see the bin of water with those little bowls on a stick there. So as I approach holy ground, and I'll know I'm approaching holy ground because there'll be a gateway like that there to warn us, hey, dummy, don't take your impure body onto that holy ground. Purify yourself. So I go to the little pool there. I wash my hands, take the cup, and that's to rinse my mouth out too, to purify both my mouth and my hands before I enter onto the holy ground. Motohisa Yamakagi, the 79th Grand Master of Yamakagi Shinto, wrote in a book, The Essence of Shinto, when the sacred area is contaminated, the spiritual vibration of the spirit of Kami, Kami being the Japanese word for deities, so the spiritual vibration of the spirit of deities cannot permeate. This is because the spiritual light is cut off in much the same way that a dirty mirror does not reflect objects well. So priests clean temples, they ritually wash the objects, they cast sprinkles of water on people and objects and at the temples and at aspects of nature. Hare puts us and our material world in the proper state to encounter the other world, the sacred world, and the holiness of the deities and beings of the other world. A fifth way that water played in world religions was as an agent of transformation. I have a brief We're going to look at a brief video in Sikhism, and it has an unnecessarily long introduction of like 20 seconds, but we'll just deal with that.
Evolved by Guru Gobind Singh on the day of Baisakhi, 1699. The nectar or amrit is used to baptize the young and old alike, and once baptized, he or she becomes a khalsa or pure. The sword used to mix this amrit is edged, signifying devotion on one side and power on the other. It is believed that anyone tasting this amrit gets the power of combat and that of devotion, thus distinguishing him from the rest of the people and becoming a Singh or lion.
So this is Sikhism that emerged in northern India in the late 1600s. So what we saw here was their equivalent of an initiation ceremony. The narrator mentioned 1699. This date's particularly important. In that year, the 10th and final guru in Sikhism created the ceremony that we just saw there. When you undertake it, you become khalsa, meaning a pure one, and you then are able to take the title of Singh if you're male, and Kaur if you're female. And you then agree to live by a strict moral code, no tobacco, no alcohol, no meat, and there's a strict dress code. As you saw, they were all dressed alike. I'm sure you noticed them putting wafers into the water. The wafers are sugar wafers, and that is what transforms the water from ordinary water into a nectar and holy water. So adding the wafers and then stirring it with the sword and saying prayers as we do so transforms it then from something ordinary into something extraordinary. So the initiate, then, the person to be brought into Sikhism, consumes the water. The video showed someone drinking it. And they also have it poured on their head. The idea here is that the holy nectar, the amrit, then by being poured on my head and by both consuming it, it's trickling into my entire mind and body. That the holy power, the holy nectar is now within me. So through that amrit then, the Sikh is transformed. Just as the water was ordinary, and through that process has become extraordinary, so now I, who was an ordinary human being, am now a special human being, a pure one, a member of the Sikh community, who now lives as God has instructed us to live. And that devotion will ultimately, the Sikhs believe, grant them release from death and into immortality. Amrit is so important in Sikhism that it also surrounds their holiest site, the Golden Temple at Amritsar. Oh, we lost the projector entirely? Okay. If it's of interest to you, I can post an image to that in Facebook later, or you can just search Golden Temple. You'll be able to find it. So in northern India, in the city of Amritsar, there is the holiest site in Sikhism. It's where that ritual was invented. And the temple is gorgeous. It is literally golden. And there is water surrounding the entire temple. And the belief in Sikhism is that that water is also amrit, or holy water, holy nectar. So the city that the golden temple is in is called Amritsar. I couldn't find a direct translation of it, but one would assume it must mean like place of the holy nectar or city of holy nectar or something like that. Okay, and finally, let's move on to looking at water from a religious humanist perspective by pondering two paradoxes of nature. So on the one hand, water is necessary for life. Yeah, that's obvious, but it is still true. And it's not just necessary for life, it is necessary for all life as we know it. Physicist Philip Ball said in an interview with NASA that it is also true for all life as we do not yet know it. So far as we can imagine, life on other planets would also need water. And the reason is that water has the super ability to hydrogen bond, which makes it an excellent solvent. By being an excellent solvent, water enables complicated chemical processes. So without water, it's unlikely life forms would be able to emerge. That would be complicated in any kind of manner. So that's why NASA's policy is to, quote, follow the water in the search for alien life. So that's one side of our paradox. Water is life. On the other hand, however, water can also be death. Drowning is an obvious threat. According to an article in a New England Journal of Medicine, if you are submerged in water for 6 to 10 minutes, there's a 56% rate of fatality or major brain damage. And that raises to 88% if you're immersed for 11 to 25 minutes. What may be a less obvious threat is hyponatremia or water intoxication. Did you know you can die from too much water? So too much water will lower our sodium levels, which then swells our brain. Too much water enters into our brain cells and swells them, and if it becomes bad enough, our brain can push against our skull in a very painful and lethal way. So life and death. There's another paradox to water. Water can be so beautiful. We want to be around it. Many people plan their vacations around water, as Reverend Steph and his family are doing. The most valuable real estate in most places, where does it tend to be? Along water. Many of us love waterfalls and find them magical. The scent of ozone and plant oils from rain can smell so wonderful. Walking in the quiet of a light snow can be very delightful. In all these ways and more, water can be a beautiful and pleasing and spiritual thing. Yet paradoxically, water can also hammer us. Flooding, hurricanes, tidal waves can be deadly beyond imagination. Some major examples from recent history include Hurricanes Katrina and Harvey, the 2004 Indian Ocean earthquake and tsunami. In more distant history, but it could be within the memories of some of our parents and grandparents, there was a great flood in 1913 right here. And it's too bad I don't have the images to show you. I found some postcards of the time, including some pictures of Muncie and what it looked like in 1913. But the flood pushed thousands of people out of their homes, destroyed hundreds of bridges, an estimated 12,000 telegraph and telephone lines. So water can be beautiful, and it can stomp us. So water as the source of the universe, water as an elemental force, water as divinity, water as purification, water as transformation, and water as paradox. We looked at all of those today. The religions of the world have shown all of these various sides of water. And what can we take away from this information? I believe it is fair to say that humanity has always appreciated the inherent paradoxes of water. Rain and storms, stillness and fury, beauty and might, creation and destruction, life and death. They're all embodied in the wonder and awesome power of water. A riddle in Taoism encapsulates this nicely. So how is it that water is so soft that when I put my hand in it, it yields and parts for me, but yet it is also so strong that it can erode and move rock? I think water has this lesson to offer us. There are times to be gentle, and there are times to be strong. The greatest power comes not from being one or the other, but from being adaptable to our circumstances and exerting nurturing, life-giving gentleness when life calls for it, and four, exerting relentless pressure, strength, and power when life calls for that. May the elemental mystery, the purifying and transformational power, the calm and strength, the beauty and depth, and the life-giving properties of water be an inspiration to you in whatever theology gives you life and keeps you afloat amid the storms of life. So be it, and so may it be. Before we move to our final hymn, we're going to need blue hymnals, or teal hymnals, so if you don't have one, we'll have to scramble and get that done before we can finish.